Rabbis call him pastor. Pastors call him rabbi. His patients call him doc. And his New York family calls him Meshuga. Crazy. Because he believes in Messiah. Welcome to this episode of To Life, where Miles Weiss highlights the hope behind the headlines.
Welcome to this edition of To Life. I'm Miles Weiss, and my guest today is a good friend and kind of a hero of mine, Eugene Bach, from the Back to Jerusalem movement out of China. He is working with the House Church movement in China and helping missionaries go throughout the 1040 window, so-called, on the way back to Jerusalem. I met Eugene when he saw me on television teaching about the gates of Jerusalem from Israel. And he flew to San Francisco in order to take us to lunch and to discuss with us the possibility of our coming to China and working alongside him, which we eventually were able to do, which is a thrill for us, a highlight of our ministry life. Eugene is a retired U.S. Marine sniper. He's the perfect point man for Brother Yun and the Back to Jerusalem movement. It's a supernaturally run movement that is really spreading love and peace and faith and power around the world. And so today we're going to discuss the parallels between the Cultural Revolution of China that led to the communist takeover of China and what we're seeing in the United States today. So without further ado, we welcome our good friend, Brother Eugene from China. Brother Eugene from Back to Jerusalem, it is so good to be with you again. I love talking to you. We can talk for hours at times. And so I really feel like you have something to say to our listeners about what you're seeing in America, not just from parts unknown, because you're always somewhere in the world, somewhere exotic, but because you've been living in China for 20 years and you know the history of the Cultural Revolution in China. And I really hope you would be able to enlighten us about the parallels between what's going on right now in America and what you've seen historically and your view of what's going on with us as well.
Yeah, you know, I've been closely watching the news, following what's happening in the United States, and I have been completely blown away by what I feel is almost like a complete carbon copy of Mao Zedong's rising in China to establish communism in 1949.
Can I ask you to explain for our millennials and youngers, the under 30s, who is Mao and what did he do? They probably don't know who he was.
You know, and you don't have to be a millennial to not know who Mao Zedong is. I embarrassingly, when I first moved to China in 1999, and I consider myself a history buff, I did not know who Mao Zedong was.
Wow.
I didn't study Mao Zedong in school, high school. I didn't go to a liberal school. I didn't go to a conservative school. I went to a high school in Indiana in the middle of a cornfield, and I never learned about Mao Zedong.
Wow.
I made up for it after I arrived because, I mean, everything that has to do with life in China revolves around Mao Zedong. His face is on the currency of all of the money that you use inside of China. So Mao Zedong is probably responsible for killing more people than almost any other human being in the history of man. I know that a lot of people would look at Russia and their rise to communism as well. Mao Zedong rivals their numbers, though maybe Russia does edge them out if you look at the official numbers. But you're talking about a man who came to power, established communism in China in 1949, and is responsible for at least 70 million deaths. I am doing this call right now from Sweden. To put that in perspective, that's like killing everybody in Sweden and bringing them back to life and doing it nine times over again.
Wow.
That's how many people Mao Zedong killed.
So for our listeners, and you're right, it's not millennials, it's my generation as well, although my particular generation, the Woodstock generation, we were actually carrying the Little Red Book around thinking we were onto something great. And unfortunately, those people are now teaching college. So help us understand what we're seeing right now in America vis-a-vis the ability of a dictator to take over a culture.
Well, let me try to put it in Chinese perspective and see if those that are familiar with what they're seeing on their TV screen or their computer screen in America, see if there's any parallels that they make. In 1949, Mao Zedong comes to power, and he comes to power by leading a revolution in China to establish equality for the people by working together with college students and union members. Those were the two major people groups that he worked a lot with. And what did he want to do? He wanted to bring up the minorities who have been oppressed inside of China by the Han people. Oddly enough, Mao Zedong was Han. You know, when a lot of people think of Chinese, they think everybody in China is the same and looks the same. But actually, China is as diverse as Europe. The middle of China is as different from Western China as England is from Italy or Slovakia. The language is different. The culture is different. The history is different. Everything is different. So what Mao did is he said, listen, what you have is you have this 1% that's at the top, and they control everything. They control the education. They control the business. And all of the minority people and the women are not able to get jobs. They're not able to advance in their careers. They're not able to get loans to buy houses. They're not able to get an education because of their people group, because they are a minority, basically because the color of their skin. And women have been kept down for generations. They're forced to bind their feet. If you're not familiar with foot binding, that was a big practice in China where when you were a baby girl, they wrapped your feet really tight and would not let your feet grow because it was considered to be very attractive for a lady to have small little feet when she became a woman. It was a very cruel practice, and it made a lot of women, it was very difficult for them to work. So he was the champion of the little people. He was the champion of the oppressed minorities. And then in the 1960s, there was a student group that rose up mainly because of an opera play that had really stirred in the hearts of a lot of young people about the oppression of minorities. And that was what we call the Cultural Revolution. And so Mao Zedong pushed very hard to get this cultural revolution to be spread throughout all of China. And the Cultural Revolution did four major things. It was to destroy the four olds, the four old things. So they wanted to get rid of old culture, old teachings, old systems. There was a focus on getting rid of all of this system that was rigged against women and minorities. And so the Cultural Revolution started to go through causing riots, doing protests, and attacking people that did not agree with them. One of the first things that they did is they went around destroying statues. Wow. Statues that represented the old culture. Statues that represented oppressive leaders. And in fact, in some cases, they even went into graveyards of these old generals, these old leaders that were held in very reverent positions in Chinese culture. They dug up their dead bodies and hung them from trees.
Wow.
Young students would wear red armbands on their arms, and they would go into the streets, and they became a law unto themselves. In fact, in 1962, the Beijing police director told all of his police officers, stand down. Do not interfere with anything that these guys are doing. And the Cultural Revolution students and protesters demanded that the police remove themselves because they were the gatekeepers of this oppressive system. And they went around into libraries and schools, destroying books, punishing professors that taught anything that they didn't like. They changed street names. Any street name that represented oppression, they changed it. They even changed the meaning of traffic lights so that when the traffic lights would turn green, they would stop because green meant money and greed and capitalism. And they would go on red because red was for revolution. And they wanted a revolution to destroy the old system and to bring about a completely new system that would bring equality for everyone. There was a financial gap between the minorities and the Han Chinese people. There was a 1%. Of course, they used the terms bourgeoisie to represent that 1%. And they used the terms proletariat to represent everybody else that was being oppressed. And they tried to find many ways that people were oppressed. The workers' unions, they were oppressed. They did all the work, but the man that owned the business, he made all the money. those that did nothing but invest in stocks, those that inherited money from their family. And so they went around destroying all these old elements of culture to reinstate their vision of a new society. That is what took place inside of China. You tell me if any of that sounds familiar.
Oh my gosh, you're blowing my mind. The parallels are so exact. We're seeing those exact things happen right now. By the way, this substantiates my joke with my wife. I tell her, you know, you're Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. I believe George Orwell was an optimist.
I just saw a meme today that said, make 1984 fiction again.
That's good. I love that. I don't know how familiar people are with that picture, but it was kind of a novelistic version of what happened in Soviet Russia, what's happening in China. You know, all these oppressive societies. First, two questions. One is, why would the police, who tend to be center-right, strong for the people, for the country, trying to do the right thing in general? We understand there are bad apples, but come on. In general, the police are for the USA. Why would they stand down? Just because a left-wing city council or mayor or governor says you got to stand down? Is that how that works in our country?
Well, I have to go back to China again. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because words matter. It's a part of the warfare. China practices it today. They've written books. I've read extensively on the books that they've written about political warfare, economic warfare. And the way that they use terminology and words is so important, because what happens is they need to not just set up an idea that's easy to tear down. They need to guard it with vocabulary that if you attack the idea, they can throw out the vocabulary, change the meaning, and then that bounces back your attack onto you. And that may not make sense, but think about this. Black lives matter. Who would not agree with that?
Of course they matter.
What kind of Christian, I don't know anybody that would not agree with that. It's a genius setup. Mao Zedong did the same thing. Minorities are being oppressed, and we need to stand up for them. And if you're against Mao Zedong, you're against minorities.
Right.
If you're against Mao Zedong, you're for women being oppressed. So if you say something against the organization of Black Lives Matter, then you immediately become the target, because you are attacking a phrase, an idea, a concept that is beyond reproach in many ways, that everybody already agrees with that. And without digging any deeper, you look like a complete Nazi by saying, no, Black Lives Matter is an evil organization. It's genius in the marketing. Communists have always been genius with marketing. One of the things that's been amazing is that working with the organization that I work with back to Jerusalem, even though I've lived in China for the last 20 years, I haven't just lived in China. I've spent the last 20 years working with back to Jerusalem missionaries who are Chinese missionaries that work in many different countries. So I've had the privilege, if you want to call it that, of working in places like North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Ethiopia. When you go into those countries, Ethiopia, thank God, is no longer a communist nation, but it was. And what they suffered, what Cambodia suffered, what China suffered, what North Korea is suffering today, is a result of Marxist theory, which has been pushed by both Mao Zedong as well as Black Lives Matter. One of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, it was revealed in an interview that she did where she said very clearly, we are trained Marxists. Their desire is the same as I saw with Mao Zedong. Here's the thing also with Cultural Revolution. They believed that fathers have no place in the home, because that patriarchal system where fathers are in the home continues to perpetuate an oppressive society that is in place that they want to tear down inside of China. So the way to destroy that is by removing the strong man in the house.
Right.
This was very clearly a part of the strategy. So what they did was they did communal living. They did communal eating. They did communal family raising, where the community was responsible for raising the children. Everybody would go and eat together in the community. people would have to watch on their neighbors. Marriages were arranged by the government. You weren't allowed to necessarily go and marry who you wanted. The government had to. I don't know if you remember Yao Ming, who is one of the, you know, big NBA stars.
I do.
You may not know him, but a lot of people know him. He's very famous.
Yes.
By the way, Yao Ming's mother, she was one of the college students that participated in the Cultural Revolution. Mm. She went and got her basketball coach and basically publicly humiliated him because he taught people to compete with one another. They believed in participation trophies. Everybody is in this together. There should be no winners, no losers. It's an equal society.
Right.
And so they went after the coaches. And the government arranged for Yao Ming's mother and father to marry. Why? Because they wanted to create a hybrid. They wanted to create a human that would be very good at basketball and very tall and height. So they took two people that were very tall, good at basketball, from the Chinese Olympic team, and they had them get married. Yao Ming was the result.
That is astounding. We're living in the science fiction of the 50s and 60s. We're living in it now. You know, it's just incredible to me, the level of social engineering, cultural engineering, and the experiment that's going on right now in America of how quickly and how compliant will we be when the boot comes down and we're not passing the test here. It's really sad to see.
And that's why we have the Bible, I really feel. I mean, you know, when I read the Old Testament, when I read the New Testament, I see the same trials and tribulations that hit me today. And I think the enemy, it's in his best interest to remove history, to destroy history, because history tells us the evil that we are capable of. I mean, the Holocaust museums don't exist so we can glorify what took place during World War II.
Right.
They exist so that we will remember the evil that we are capable of. They exist so that we will not ever go down those roads that led to the extermination of so many innocent people. But one of the museums that we didn't set up were all of those that have died during the Cultural Revolution in China, all of those that died during the killing fields of Cambodia, all of those that died during the Communist Revolution in Russia, all of those that died during the Communist Revolution in Ethiopia. And for some reason, we have forgotten that history. For some reason, we have embraced a theory, the Marxist theory, that has proven to not just be a failure, but to be deadly over and over on every continent and almost every country that's been tried. It's never succeeded. And still we have young people that are passionate. And I believe that their passion comes from a good place, but they're ignorant on what they believe has already done and caused misery and pain to so many people.
It's such a sign of narcissism for any of us to think that this thing that has failed and been made, you know, millions and millions of deaths for people, et cetera, just what you've said, that we'll do it right because what, we're better people? How is that mentality? Has it gripped our young people here in America that, oh, that was their socialism, their communism. When we do it in America, it's going to be better. Can you speak to that? I want to say almost the psychological bent coupled with ignorance of history.
Yes. And Miles, I believe that it is spiritual.
Yes.
I really do.
Yes.
When you look at the Korean Peninsula, that is about as homogenistic as you get for a people group. Unless you go to Iceland or something. But as a people group, that is about as homogenized as you get. You got the same people, same language, same history, same background, same culture on the same peninsula. Divide them in two. In the South, you give freedom to the Christians. In the North, you take away the freedom of the Christians and you persecute the Christians. And what do you get? The North actually believes in science as their religion, so they say. But their science sucks. It's the worst science in the entire world. Look, that's not because they're Asian. Look at Germany. You take the same people, same language, same culture, same background, split them in two, East Germany and West Germany. People were dying to get to West Germany because East Germany sucks so much.
Right.
Look at Ethiopia. Before communism and after communism. Today, Ethiopia is one of the more wealthy nations on the African continent. I would much rather be in Ethiopia than in Chad, Sudan, Somalia. When you look at what communism has done to the people in Cuba, what it's doing today to the people in Venezuela, it doesn't matter the culture, it doesn't matter the background, it doesn't matter the intelligence. What matters is that Marxist theory starts off at its foundation that Christianity and communism are incompatible. And you have to destroy Christianity in order for communism to work. And therein lies the main element of destruction that brings equal distribution of misery to everyone.
You know, I was thinking about the WHO that President Trump is trying to extricate us from, and I don't know how that's going to work out, whether it's going to be real or showboat, but I hope it's real, because I was looking at their charter from 1948, and it's explicitly in there. In order to have health worldwide and a worldwide peace, we need to divorce people from individualism, nationalism, religion, and traditional family. It's right in their charter.
Wow. Yeah. That is the recipe for disaster. And we've seen it across the globe in different generations and different nations and different cultures and different people. And when I look at the rise of communism inside of China, one of the things that I find especially disturbing is the thought police, that they don't only want you to do what they want you to do. They want you to think it as well. They don't want you to do what they tell you to do, but then have other thoughts. They want to control your thoughts as well. And one of the things that I found very interesting is that if you look at the communist revolution and the cultural revolution inside of China, one of the things that they did that went along with the Little Red Book that you talked about that you carried around is that everybody read the Little Red Book. And if you've never heard of the Little Red Book, for those of your listeners, that is the second most printed book in the history of man. At the time that it was printed, it was the most printed book for that year of any other book in the world. But it's the second most printed book. And everybody inside of China had to carry it. Everybody had to read it in their free time. And it was to change the way they think, because remember, Cultural Revolution wanted to get rid of the four olds, and one of those things was old thoughts. And so what they would do is every week or every month, depending on where you lived, you had to go to a confession session where you had to confess to people thoughts that you might have had, things that you might have witnessed that broke the communist law, but you didn't say anything. So you had to confess your sins, and nobody was allowed to say, I don't have any sins. Everybody had to make confessions. When I see the rise of what's taking place in the U.S., it's not at the same level, but I do see elements of this confession, this white guilt, this idea that I'm one of the oppressors, therefore I need to confess. I need to make public confessions on TV or in marches of my privilege. The privilege that I have had and how that has kept other people down. It was the exact same thing during the Cultural Revolution, during these confession sessions.
Well, we are seeing that all over the country right now, especially coming out of Hollywood and the elite and those that are set for life financially. They have this incredible virtue signaling, as it's called, to come forward and make these inane proclamations. They may not have actually been racist, may not have actually had that kind of thinking. Talk about how it begins with, I think it begins with your language, and then they go after your thoughts. Right now, they're after our language. You're not allowed to have a different opinion. We used to be able to have a dialogue. It was attributed to Voltaire. He didn't actually say it, but they say Voltaire said, I may disagree with you, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. We've lost that in America. People are running scared, especially conservatives are running scared. I love the odd ones like you and one of my go-to guys, Adam Carolla. I'm not recommending him, Christians. Adam Carolla, he goes out his way to say, I will not apologize because I haven't done that, you know, and he just will not. And so they leave him alone. But once you start apologizing and begging for mercy and bowing the knee to something other than the Lord, you're on the road to perdition. I mean, what would you say about that, how the language is now being affected in the USA?
The way that we saw it transpire in China was that you did not even have to be guilty. All you had to do was be accused. And if you were accused, it was your job to prove your innocence. So the idea of being innocent until proven guilty did not exist in China's thought police confessions. So when people said, I heard you say, and you could reply and say, that's not what I meant, didn't matter. So we even saw the president of China. So Mao Zedong was the chairman, and he was the puppet master, but there was also a president. And so Mao Zedong had all of the top leaders put in labor camps, re-education camps. Those re-education camps still exist today. And in fact, we have more than 1 to 1.5 million people. And I would love a chance maybe in the future to share with you, just in the last couple months, I've just been on this research bench doing interviews with people about the organ harvesting that's taking place out of these re-education camps.
I saw it on your website. And I just want to say, by the way, for our listeners, that if you're not aware of Back to Jerusalem, you need to get a hold of their website, backtojerusalem.org. Listen to the podcast, read the letters, get Eugene's books. But oh my gosh, brother, it's stunning.
Yeah. So one of the things that we see is these re-education camps. And I've written about it extensively from those that have experienced it firsthand. One of the books that goes very deep into it is a book called I Stand With Christ, together with Pastor Zhongrong Liang. You can look him up on Wikipedia. His church is one of the largest denominations in the world with over 10 million believers. And it took us about 2 years, me traveling together with him, writing his story. But he talks about the change of language where they beat it into you and they create a culture of fear for you to not only stop words that might get you in trouble, but stop the thoughts that might lead to those words. And when you bring in fear, what you do is you remove thoughts. You begin to create a society of robots that regurgitate information and do exactly what they're told. So it's kind of like seeing an abused child, you know, where the child has been conditioned to be abused if they do anything wrong. And so in China, if they do something wrong, they say something wrong, they think something wrong, they have this immediate reaction of what will the government do? And it creates a society that becomes very unproductive because nobody wants to be creative. Nobody wants to really search for truth. What they want to do is please the party. And when you have that, you ruin science. You ruin education. You ruin poetry. There are so many arts that become destroyed when you begin to attack language and thought.
Wow. I'm seeing that in California right now. We have this tyrannical masking issue that is not based on true science, but it's basically come out of Ferguson, Dr. Pants down in the UK, and Fauci from the CDC, et cetera. Here in California, you have to wear a mask to go into a restaurant. But once you sit down, you can take the mask off. And that is because, and I have this on the highest authority, that is because when you're walking, your feet are too porous and the virus can come up into you, so you need to have a mask. But when you sit down, your butt has magical prophylactic qualities that that defends you against the COVID virus. That's absolutely scientific as the stuff we've been hearing the last 4 months.
Brother, I would tell you that it even goes deeper than that, because if you look, you'll see that China has invested tens of millions into the different movie production companies in California. Yep. And so these movie production companies actually hire Chinese movie companies to advise them on what they can put in their movie and what they can't, so that the Chinese government will not be displeased with their production.
Right. Yeah, I know. And it's coming up with some major films that are coming out. Now, that's a whole other show we'll have to do, a whole other program, because give us a one-minute version of the borrowed boat.
It's the Chinese PLA, which is their People's Liberation Army. It is their theory. It's called borrowed boats theory. In Chinese, it's borrow a boat to go to sea. That is what it's called. But in English, we call it the borrowed boats theory. And what that means is that the Chinese know that they cannot sell Westerners, in this case, Americans, to get into their communist boats. But they already exist in certain boats. So China has taken over those boats without people knowing, without the passengers knowing, and are driving them towards communism in their own boats. So for instance, GE, General Electric, owned by China, AMC Theaters, owned by China, Ritz-Carlton, owned by China, Volvo, owned by China. I can go through company after company that is owned by China, and China uses those companies to get their message out. That is the essence of the borrowed boats theory. And they've done it through entertainment, such as Hollywood movies, and they also do it through news outlets like Washington Post, New York Post, LA Post.
Wow. Well, brother, we could do this all day. The subtitle of this podcast is going to be Hope Behind the Headlines. So as we close today, what gives you hope today?
What gives me hope is I continue to see the gospel rise among the people. What is great is people's faith usually grows under opposition. I'd rather not have opposition, but I always see positive things from God's people come out when they have to exercise their faith in Christ. That makes me excited.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To Life, where we look for the hope behind the headlines. It was great to speak with our guest today, and we're looking forward to many more issues with you. We'll be able to cover things of culture, politics, spirituality, because it is a chaotic world out there, but there's always hope behind the headlines and a message to life.